Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle and the Insider's insight into today's most pressing issues. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, although much of the world is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, there is a war on this continent that is claiming thousands of lives and threatening to destabilize Mexico that is related to the drug war. Then on the Scholar Circle, how is the so-called war on drugs connected to the underground lethal drug trade? And how can societies more effectively and humanely solve drug-related problems? Although much of the world is focused on the conflicts in the Middle East, there is a war on this continent that is claiming thousands of lives and threatening to destabilize parts of Mexico that is related to the drug war. The effects are far-reaching, changing the economics and society, particularly in Mexico, but also in parts of the United States. The drug cartels have expanded into organized crime, and they are particularly affecting women. In Chihuahua, nearly 600 women were killed in just 2 years. And women are increasingly involved with criminal enterprises. In fact, the female prison population has increased 400% since 2007, according to the New York Times. Making matters worse is a so-called media blackout. The media have, in many cases, been effectively silenced. What is occurring in Mexico, and what is driving this? We're joined by two experts. Guadalupe Correa Cabrera is a professor of political science at the University of Texas. She specializes in Latin American politics with a focus on Mexico. Molly Malloy is a research librarian for Latin America and the border at New Mexico State University, and she is the creator of the Frontera List, which reports on the events in Mexico. Molly Malloy, perhaps we should start with you. How can we understand what it's really like going on, particularly in these border regions of Mexico? What do we need to know to understand this?
One of the things I try to do is to document specifically for Ciudad Juarez, which is the border city closest to El Paso, Texas, in the United States. It's a short walk from one city to the next across the international bridges. And beginning in 2008, beginning in January, the number of people killed in that city every day just began to skyrocket. I'm going to throw out numbers, and I know this sounds boring, but this is why it's so important, I think, to try to get a handle on what's going on. In January and February of 2008, about 50 people per month, each of those months, was killed. In March, it went up to about 120. By the end of 2008, it was averaging more than 200 people per month. That continued to increase all through 2009 and 2010. Basically, in the year before, 2007, about 300 people were murdered in Juarez. By the end of 2010, the annual number of people killed was over 3,000. So the increase was just incredible, and the actual death toll from homicide, from murder, just skyrocketed. The murder rate in Juarez at the end of 2010 was probably close to 300 per 100,000. That's not a precise calculation because we don't know precisely how many people live in the city now. Because of the continuing escalating violence, it's estimated that about 200 to 250,000 people have left the city. So we know that the population is somewhere between 1 million and 1.3 million, but we really don't know how many people actually still live in Juarez. In addition to the murders, about 25% of the housing has been abandoned. There are whole neighborhoods where people have left, and the houses have just been vacant and vandalized, many of them. There have also been an extraordinary number of businesses that have closed. Many of the people that own those businesses have moved to El Paso, where their families and their businesses can be safe. In addition to the drug-related violence, the war between the so-called Juarez cartel versus the Sinaloa cartel, and they're killing each other in gang fights and things like this, there's also a skyrocketing number of killings that are apparently related to extortion, people who will not pay money to these criminal organizations to protect them, and many people are killed for those reasons. And many people are killed for reasons that we do not really understand. A lot of people have been killed in drug rehab clinics. There have been mass shootings where 10, 15, up to 20 people have been killed in a single place. And understanding it is very, very difficult because the rhetoric is all that these are criminals being killed by other criminals. But most of the murders, 95% of the murders, are not investigated. So we really don't know why so many people have died in Juarez. The killings across Mexico probably range now up to 45 to 50,000 people since the beginning of President Calderon's administration. About one-fifth of those have been killed in one city, and that's Juarez. That's why I focus on it, because even though the killing is spreading out to many other places in the country, the really highest murder rate, the epicenter of the violence, I believe is still in Ciudad Juarez.
Molly Malloy, you used a phrase in another interview, social pathology, to describe Juarez. You said that the entire social fabric is changing. Young people are becoming nihilistic. They're attracted to gangs, crime, violence, living fast, dying young. Is it possible to have a normal life in a place like Juarez anymore?
There are certainly people that try. I was just talking to a good friend of mine who lives there. He's a journalist, and he tries to have a normal life. But what's become normal is to never give anyone your phone number, to never answer your telephone unless you absolutely know who is calling, to never invite people to your house for a social gathering unless you absolutely know that no one will bring anyone that you do not know. In other words, he told me that he had had a recent social party, a little gathering at his home. Someone came with someone he didn't know, and he had to tell them to leave. Things like that. If that's considered normal, and this is a middle-class person. This is a person with a job, with an income, with a nice place to live. So I wouldn't consider that a normal way to live. For the majority of people in Juarez, though, people who are poor, people who have jobs that don't pay a living wage or no jobs at all, it's hard to imagine some of the things that have happened to these people. The estimate is that there could be as many as 10,000 or maybe even up to 20,000 orphans in the city of Juarez, meaning children who have lost at least one parent because of the violence. Children who've seen their parents or their father or their mother or the person who takes care of them killed in front of their eyes, shot down in the street or in their home. Trying to imagine the trauma for every single one of these thousands of children, to me, brings up ideas that, you know, are so far from normal that I can't quite even describe it. Because I know that from talking to people who do social work, who do counseling with children who've experienced traumatic events, such as school shootings or something in the United States, these children can be traumatized for years unless they get counseling. And even then, sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes it doesn't help. Imagine the level of violence in Juarez going on and all of the children who are affected, and very few of them ever get any kind of counseling. Many of them don't even have an immediate relative that they can live with after this trauma happens to them. Many are sent to live with distant relatives in the United States if they are lucky enough to have such a relative. Many are sent to orphanages. It's a pretty traumatic thing when you think of it, because obviously this violence did not come from one event. It was building, I believe, for generations because of the social conditions in the city. And it's certainly not going to be over in a single generation.
Let's bring in Guadalupe Correa Cabrera. Guadalupe Correa, you are studying the politics of the region. How can we possibly understand the politics of this and how this developed and how it is manifesting itself still today?
Well, the politics of the region, and you're talking about the border or you're talking about the country? Because the border dynamics regarding to politics are different from the rest of the country due to many things. And even the border cannot be analyzed as a whole. The analysis has to be divided into three because we have three different borders. due to the geographic situation, to the culture, to the history of these regions. Regarding the border and the politics of the border, we can talk about three borders. One is Juarez, El Paso, one is Tijuana, San Diego, and the other one is the Texas-Tamaulipas border. The three of them are controlled by different drug trafficking organizations or drug cartels or organizations or groups of organized crime. What really would you like to know? Would you would like to know more about the border, or you would like to know about the politics in general?
It sounds like they're pretty connected.
They are pretty connected because the problem that we are living right now has to do with the trafficking of some goods, I mean, to the north and to the south. It has to do with trafficking, people trafficking, arms trafficking, and drug trafficking, which also has an impact on the rest of the countries. What happens with our relationship with the United States affects and has a very important impact on what happens in the rest of the country. However, Mexico is a very complex country with different regions and with different dynamics taking place here, and different groups of organized crime controlling different parts of the country. What really happened is in 2006, and this problem has gone on and much before, and we know that drug trafficking organizations have been making their business much before, right? But before, we had a one-party dominated politics in the country, and the party, the PRI, that dominated the politics for 70 years was capable of controlling, in a way, the business and having some pacts with these groups, and there was like a pact between them, a few organizations that there were in that time. But then the party lost the election in 2000, and then we had a different dynamic. The new democracy changed the whole dynamics in many respects. And now the president does not have the power to decide or to control the situation. Now the different governors make the different pacts or different agreements or fight in a different way drug trafficking organizations. This is one thing. The other thing was because of September 11 and the United States closing the border and spending more money on border security. This also had an impact on what we're living right now, on the violence in Mexico, on drug violence and border violence, which are connected in reality, because it has to do with a business that has a connection with the United States. People want to go to the United States to work. A drug cartel sells the drugs in the United States, and it's a big business because of the consumption of drugs in the United States. And also, we have the issue of trafficking. That right now, trafficking is a big issue because, I mean, the allegations are that people are killing each other because of the arms that are coming from the north. So there are many things. I mean, it's very complex. One thing is the new democratic area in Mexico, this new democracy that decentralized power, and now the president is capable of taking control of the situation, even though they are trying to design a strategy. There is not a good coordination between the federal agencies and the state agencies, as it was before with the 70 years of the PRI. This is a new democracy, and we don't know how to deal with that democracy. There's another thing. Is the United States, I mean, the closing of the borders, which does not allow some of these groups to sell the drugs to the United States, and some of these drugs are staying in Mexico, and this is also having an impact on the violence right now because the drugs are consumed inside of the country. And another thing is arms trafficking. I mean, the arms that are sent to Mexico are being used by these drug trafficking organizations to cause this violence. This violence is unique. Because, and I've been studying this phenomenon for some time, because right now we have observed phenomenon that we haven't observed before, which is the paramilitarization of drug cartels in Mexico, which means, like, with the creation of the Zetas, this new form of organized crime using high-caliber arms and paramilitary tactics. The Zetas were part of the special forces of the army in Mexico, and they went out of the army, and they were involved into drug trafficking organizations. So right now it's very difficult to fight these groups without military practices. So the government decided to participate, putting the military, and this has caused a war that has been very violent. These new practices have never been observed before in Mexico. We have never observed the usage of these kind of arms or heads in the floor, and these kind of arms that look that these kind of tactics that resemble us to a war. So this is a phenomenon that is very complicated, because with the same strategy that the government is using right now, the cartels or the drug trafficking organizations have been having problems, and they have been separating each other, and we have been serving the creation of new cartels. So as far as we know, and also if you observe the number of murders, last year we had a total of drug-related murders from 2006, the late 2006 to 2010, of 35,612. And right now, we don't have the exact number, but some of the sources say that we have 50,000 people dead because of this kind of war. So it means that the strategy of the government has to be revised, because we are not observing like a stabilization of the situation in any region of the country. On the contrary, we have been observing this problem and this violence growing in every single part of the country. And the border especially, because on the border, it's a place where the drug cartel sites do send their products to the United States. So basically, it's very difficult to talk about Mexico right now, because we cannot only talk about one thing, which is drug trafficking. We have to talk about organized crime, kidnapping, extortion, which is another part of organized crime. We have to talk about money laundering. We have to talk about underdevelopment and poverty and inequality, which is also very important to understand why people in Mexico, women, young people and men are involved in drug cartel organizations. So it's a very complicated situation that has to be addressed in different directions, and we have to understand the different aspects of this. And analyzing the whole picture is very complicated. We have to analyze it part by part to understand what's going on.
Anything you'd like to add, Molly Malloy?
Well, one thing I would like to add is sort of to challenge the idea that when President Calderon took office, his major objective was to wage a war on the drug cartels. What I really believe the strategy of the Mexican government is to gain control over the economic benefits of the drug trafficking business. It's estimated that the drug trade in Mexico, especially, you know, the trade from Mexico into the United States of various drugs, marijuana, cocaine, heroin, mostly, methamphetamines and other materials also, but those are the main ones. It's estimated that it earns somewhere between $30 billion and perhaps as high as $60 or $80 billion to the Mexican economy every year. Of course, these things are estimated because it's really impossible to know exactly how much money is being made, because it's in the illegal economy. But the Mexican economy needs that money. That money goes into the legitimate economy very quickly. It doesn't stay illegal for very long. There are money laundering, there are ways to launder the money that range through the banking systems all over the world, most notably in the United States and Europe. The United Nations estimated last year that it was probably proceeds from the drug business that kept some of the economic, some of the banking systems of the world afloat during the terrible crisis of 2008. If it wasn't for that liquid cash flowing through the system to banks in the United States and Europe, the crash would have been even worse than it was. And so the Mexican economy needs that money. It needs that input to its economy. And so it does need to be controlled. And I truly believe that President Calderon and his efforts to use the army is to take control of it, not actually to do away with it. And, you know, that may be controversial, but I really don't think that you can look at Mexico and look at its history, the history of the drug trade in that country, and think that it is going to be eradicated in 6 years. It's far too entrenched as a major part of the economy.
Guadalupe Correa, would you agree?
Yeah, I would agree that this is a very important area that we have to, consider, which is money laundering. And we have also to consider a very important aspect, which is the cooperation or the relationship with the United States. I don't think that this is only a problem of Mexico. I think, and I will repeat, that this also has to do with armed trafficking and drug trafficking. And I think that the countries have to talk to each other and together try to find some solutions. Because, again, I don't think this is only a problem of Mexico. We have a lot of arms that are produced in the United States that are sold in Mexico. And we sell the drugs to the United States. And also, the issue of money laundering is really important, as Molly Malone was saying. We have to also agree in some ways to try to solve this problem. The banking system and, I mean, the economic flows are important, so these people are gaining something, and they will still continue with this.
I don't want to go too deep into this next thing I'm going to mention, but I just wanted to ask. There were some accusations of the U.S. federal government supplying arms, since you both are mentioning the arms trades, supplying arms to these drug cartels. Have either of you seen evidence of that?
Well, there was this program, this sting operation, I suppose you could call it, begun by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in the United States to allow some arms to go into Mexico that would then be followed to see what happened to them. And I haven't followed it in great detail, but many of those guns were involved in crimes and were later confiscated, and this program was discovered. It's definitely true that a lot of the guns that are used to commit many of these crimes in Mexico do come from the United States. It's also true that a lot of them, we don't exactly know where they come from. The idea that 90% of the arms that can be traced come from the United States has been in the media a lot. And people seem to not notice the phrase, that can be traced. The Mexican government doesn't release the information on many of the arms that it confiscates. And so we actually don't know where those arms come from because they've never been inspected or analyzed in that way. One theory is that many of them come from the international black market for weapons, which is huge and which supplies weapons to many places in the world where conflict and war and criminal activity is very high. Another idea is that a lot of them are sort of stockpiled from the United States funding and supplying armies and guerrilla actions in Central America back in the 1980s. These things don't just disappear. They remain in the marketplace, and they can get bought and sold for years and years and used to kill people for many, many, many years to come. So we don't know where exactly all of the arms come from. We do know precisely that several thousand weapons that were involved in this Fast and Furious program by the ATF ended up in being involved in crimes in Mexico. That's absolutely been proven and testified to in Congress and other places.
Guadalupe Correa, let's talk for a moment also about something I think both of you have mentioned it in some of your pieces, but I noticed in one of your papers you talked about media and a couple of things about it. One is how the media spectacle distorts reality. And the other is, of course, there's this silencing of journalism occurring in Mexico. What is the effect of this?
Well, yes, these are two different phenomena which are really causing a lot of problems. One is the silencing of the media, especially in some parts of Mexico. What happened, the fragmentization of drug cartels controlling some important regions of the country, like Tamaulipas, for example, or like Nuevo León, or the state of Michoacán, they control the media. So it's like a matter of journalists, of course, have been killed in Juarez, so journalism has become a very dangerous profession. And what happens when we don't know what's going on? I mean, people cannot be conscious. Social consciousness disappears when we don't know really what's going on. And information is very important because it's an arm for the government to know where things are happening, what groups are working. And this is very useful for strategy. And what happens when the media cannot inform? People do not know what's going on. They don't know how to approach the authorities. So it's a big problem. The silence of the media is a very huge problem. When local media, for example, in the state of Tamaulipas, and national media is not reporting what's going on. We don't know how many people have been killed. We have some figures that are not the exact figures. And this is like a war. This is a very important thing. People are now using social media, and this is a new phenomenon. It's like a very new thing that has been helping society, civil society, to let other people know, to be aware of what's happening, to let other people understand what the situation in Mexico. The usage of Twitter, blogs, Facebook, different other means through internet is really helping in times where journalism has become a very difficult profession. Another thing is, as you mentioned, the media spectacle and the way how media is presenting reality, especially the United States media sometimes, when there's this confusion between illegal immigration, terrorism, and drug violence. Sometimes media presents these three things as the same, like drug cartels or illegal immigrants as the people who are going to commit some terrorist attack. And this is helping sometimes politicians to pass some laws, and this is problematic. We have to understand these three things, illegal immigration, terrorism, and drug trafficking, as three different things. Of course, sometimes they are connected, and some of the gangs are involved in illegal immigration to recruit some people for their armies. But sometimes, and several times, if you read my papers, the media has not been capturing things the way they are, and it serves for political purposes. And we have really to understand very well and to inform society what's really going on, society in both parts of the border, because this is going to help people in the United States understand what's going on in Mexico and Mexicans to understand what's going on in the United States in order to generate more collaboration and cooperation in a problem that it's a shared responsibility. Then we have a shared responsibility in this matter. It's not only a problem of Mexico.
Molly Malloy, last word.
I would absolutely agree. One of the problems is that there's a lot of hysteria that's generated or tries to be generated by politicians and some media outlets in the United States that the violence in Mexico is spilling over the border. And this just is not true. All of the statistics on crime in U.S. cities and towns and places close to the border are down and have consistently been going down for many, many years. It's hard for people to realize that the violence is exploding in Mexico. People are dying, and that what's happening in the United States, we are part of the market that causes the violence, but the violence itself really does not spill over the border. It's essentially, I believe, a human rights disaster, and it's caused by many factors. When President Calderon used the army to supposedly fight against the drug cartels, the violence has only consistently gone up year after year, month after month. And I believe that many of the people who are dying are innocent people who are caught in this terrible war, this terrible violence that is really entrapping many, many innocent Mexicans who are just trying to make a living.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you very much for joining us. Guadalupe Correa Cabrera is a professor of political science at the University of Texas. She specializes in Latin American politics, a focus on Mexico. Molly Malloy is a research librarian for Latin America and the border at New Mexico State University, and she's created the Frontera List, which reports on some of these occurrences she's been talking about in Mexico. Thank you both so very much. Really appreciate your time.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
When we come back, how the so-called war on drugs is connected to the underground lethal drug trade and how societies can more effectively and humanely solve their drug-related problems. Stay tuned.
Mommy! Mommy! Mommy blue! Oh, mommy blue! Mommy! Mommy! Mommy blue! Oh, mommy blue! ¿Por qué tu casa tan vacía? ¿Por qué cerrada noche y día? Oh, mami, dime dónde está. Ay, dime. Después de tanto caminar, aquí me quiero consolar y ser de nuevo niño. Ay, por ti. Bye.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm your host, Maria Armudian. The 40-year war on drugs is a failure, say many public policy experts. Billions of dollars spent on drug enforcement have yielded few positive results and in many cases have fueled very negative ones. In fact, in some ways, the hardline approach to enforcing drug laws have fueled violence and enriched some political terrorists. How are all of these matters connected? How can societies deal with the problems related to drugs more humanely and more effectively? And how close are we getting to such a path? We are joined by three experts. Mark Kleiman is a professor of public policy at the UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs and the author of many books, including When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment. Jonathan Calkins is professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University's Cotter Campus and at the Hines School of Public Policy. And Angela Hawken is a professor of economics and policy analysis at the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. Together, they have authored a book called Drugs and Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know. Let's start with 1966 and then the 1971 President Richard Nixon with the drug policies. If we were going to trace what the trends have been with regards to drugs, drug-related crimes, what would we say the trends have been? Mark Kleiman, why don't you start?
The current incarnation of the drug war really ran in two phases. There was the explosion of heroin use and concurrently, though not, I think, relatedly, of cannabis use in the 1960s. And the Rockefeller drug laws in New York State were the first attempt to systematically expand the role of the criminal justice system in dealing with drug abuse. And then Richard Nixon famously made drugs the national issue and started what's now called the war on drugs, though I don't think there's evidence he actually used that phrase. But his new policies, insofar as they were new, were expanded treatment and reduced mandatory incarceration, along with some organizational changes. But the impetus of that effort had mostly run out by the mid-1970s. So Gerald Ford actually cut the Drug Enforcement Administration budget pretty substantially. Jimmy Carter was famously committed to decriminalizing marijuana. And then the second turn, but 1979, government survey showed that more than 10% of high school seniors were daily marijuana smokers. And with a little bit of help from the federal government, parents went into a panic. And then over that same few-year period, we had the expansion of cocaine, the falling cocaine prices, and the introduction of crack. And then the full-fledged drug war in its modern guise starts around the mid-1980s with the death of Len Bias and the expansion of cocaine penalties. In 1980, we had 30,000 drug dealers behind bars. We now have 500,000.
That's a huge number.
It is a huge number.
In terms of the other kinds of trends with violence, with other societal issues that connect to drugs, are there things that we can disentangle that correlate with the increased enforcement in the 1980s and forward? Have they had an effect? And if so, what do we think the effect is?
Well, the simplest answer is that over this period of greatly increased enforcement from 1980 to today, the price of cocaine has fallen 80% and the price of heroin has fallen 90%. So those of us who believed that a consequence of increased enforcement would be increased prices and therefore decreased consumption have to go back to the drawing board.
And in terms of crime, in terms of incarceration, do we see trends there?
Well, drug-related incarceration, again, is massively up. It's not, in fact, the major contributor to our mass incarceration problem. We have 2.4 million people behind bars in this country right now. So only about 20% of that is directly drug-related offenses. But we have more people in prison for drug crimes than civilized countries do for crimes altogether. It's really a shocking situation. The violence in the drug markets has diminished very sharply. That's part of the story of why we've had a general crime and violence decline since 1994. I don't think anybody's got a theory that credits that to drug law enforcement. The other thing that's happening is that in some places we're getting smarter about how to do drug law enforcement, focusing on the violence and the disorder and not working on the fantasy that law enforcement can reduce drug abuse.
Jonathan Calkins.
Well, I think there is a theory, and the theory of how drug enforcement may have contributed to the decline in violence is simply by pushing the flagrant public street corner markets into operating in more surreptitious ways, by arranging transactions by cell phone or beeper, and by pushing it underground, you don't have the same gang control of territory, fight over turf sort of drive-by violence that was so terrifying in the 1980s. It's also true that there are big trends in use that aren't well correlated with changes in enforcement or incarceration or other policy, because drugs follow a natural epidemic cycle. They start at low rates, then something triggers availability. You get a very rapid, almost contagious spread as people who start using start introducing friends. It reaches some sort of peak and then comes back down to an endemic level below that peak. So those sorts of large changes have been going on, and sometimes it's better to think of drug policy as riding along those waves rather than being the sole thing that drives them.
Angela Hawken.
Well, in terms of managing drug use domestically over the last two decades, we've seen these large swings of a pendulum, really swinging from a treatment-oriented approach to a criminal justice-oriented approach, where the treatment providers are typically characterized as the warm-hearted and the criminal justice typically characterized as the cold-hearted. And these swings have been wrapped up in politics, in advocacy movements, in public opinion. The public has had a great deal of change in terms of how they regard drug use and incarceration for drug use. And it was really a misplaced emphasis, because what we're starting to see now is that you really can't control drug use problems without a combination of both treatment providers there to provide assistance, as well as the law enforcement in place to provide the motivation to stop the drug use. And so we are finally, I think, now starting to see more balance, and this pendulum does seem to be settling.
There are several strands that I'd like to be able to go down today. One is the relationship of drugs, crime, prison, the kind of money we're spending, the kind of societal problems we're seeing, and that relationship. And then the other one is the international drug trade and how it's related to law enforcement. I saw in your book you noted that the Mexican drug war, which is highly lethal, has some connection to U.S. policy, and I'd like to explore that a little bit. In fact, maybe we should start there now and then come back to the domestic situation. How is the Mexican drug war connected to U.S. policy?
This is John Calkins. The most fundamental connection is simply that most of the drugs that are transshipped through Mexico are destined for U.S. markets and U.S. consumers. So it is the U.S. market that provides the backdrop for Mexican organized crime organizations to be able to make enough money moving drugs to have an incentive to fight over it and to corrupt the government and give government the incentive to try to push back and control them.
The U.S. drug laws and enforcement, there's a relationship you point out in this book that contribute to this drug trade. How do we understand this? Mark Kleiman?
When we make drugs illegal and fail to control the domestic traffic, and it's very hard to get in between determined consumers and something they want to consume, we create a market for imports. And countries that wind up satisfying that demand suffer for it, among them Mexico. Mexico, of course, stands out because it's by far the best place from which to sell drugs to the U.S. And for decades, the official U.S. government stance has been that it's the responsibility of the Mexican government to shut down trafficking into the U.S. The Mexican view has been, not surprisingly, that it's the responsibility of the U.S. government to stop drug consumption and drug dealing in the U.S., which make that international traffic possible. But the Mexican government has been under very substantial pressure from the U.S. to ramp up its drug enforcement, and that has consequences in Mexico. That's a somewhat less true than it used to be. I think there's more of a recognition within the U.S. government that we can't actually solve our drug problem anywhere but here. But it's still true that Mexico's drug policy decisions are very much conditioned on the need to maintain good relations with the U.S.
Angela Hawken?
If we could find a more strategic approach to managing domestic drug demand, we'd go a long way to solving Mexico's drug trafficking problems. And our historical approaches have been largely unsuccessful. Our prisons operated at huge expense and have been largely ineffective at reforming drug use behavior. It's a very, very bad, you know, with a very large price tag, we receive very little good from shoveling and warehousing large numbers of our drug offenders. So until we have a more strategic approach to managing drug use domestically, we aren't going to be able to achieve much. And luckily, I'm the optimist here. We really are starting to see some innovation now that looks as if it holds a great deal of promise for reducing domestic drug demand by focusing on the group that's most problematic, and that's the group of high-use consumers. And those individuals tend to be criminally involved, and because we have them being handled by the criminal justice system, we have an opportunity to monitor them closely and to reform their behavior. And we are now moving in that direction in a way that looks very promising.
Well, let's talk for a moment about, first, the price tag. You said it's got this enormous price tag. Can you quantify what it is currently at, and what are we getting out of that?
Well, we're getting very little out of it. How much it costs depends on the jurisdiction that you're in California. You're looking at over $80 a day. Even in the inexpensive warehousing states, Arizona is a relatively cheap prison state, which is why they import so many prisoners from other states, you know, just over $20,000 a year. But no matter how you look at it, housing somebody in a prison cell is extremely expensive to do compared to some alternatives that we're now seeing. One of those alternatives is something that Mark and I have been working closely on for many years now, and it's a program in Hawaii, which is now being expanded quite rapidly through the mainland, called HOPE, which is a probation and parole supervision model for monitoring people very closely while they're in the community. Now, the advantage of having them in the community means we aren't paying for their room and board, and they have an opportunity to learn how to behave on the streets and hold jobs and go about their lives and be parents and children and members of a community. What HOPE's showing is that if you have a credible system in place and you warn people and you swiftly respond to any negative behavior, you can bring about change. Even hardened drug users who would otherwise be in prison cells can be managed successfully in the community. Their drug use can be suppressed and their criminal behavior can be controlled. This has the opportunity to reduce huge expenditure on prison and jail populations.
You had noted in your book that one of the things that occurs when you house drug users in prison is that they become very isolated in their cells, and they're far away from job opportunities and they're far away from communities. And it opens them up also to these other kinds of, shall we say, less communal types of activities. And that sounds like it create a negative spiral.
Absolutely. The worst thing you want to do with a drug user is separate them from any of their opportunities for success. And often that's a supporting family or community. Employment is extremely protective. Keeping people employed goes a long way to keeping their lives on track. And the policy of putting people away for long stretches of time, alienating them from their families, and alienating them from work opportunities is not a good one.
I found a lot of things really interesting in this book, and I was taken by the international section a bit. And one of the arguments that you're making is, look, if we deal with it here at home at the source and we can reduce the abuse of the illegal drugs, then we can deal with some of these other international issues more. And so one of the consequences, you noted that there's this connection between this drug trade and these terrorist groups who rent out their services to intimidate or harm officials or others. How closely is this connected, this drug trade in these kinds of terrorist acts?
There's very often a correlation between where the drug trade flourishes and where government and government institutions are weak, and you often have insurgents of various sorts. Both insurgencies and drug production and distribution flourish where central government is weak, and where insurgencies and drug trafficking flourish, that weakens the government. So they co-occur and they are related. It's easy to exaggerate the extent to which drugs finance terrorism if you think by the word terrorism of international terrorism of the September 11th sort. There's no question that the Taliban in Afghanistan do derive some revenues from the opiate trade, but that is by and large very much removed from the United States. U.S. demand is a tiny, tiny fraction of the demand on Afghan heroin. But if you define terrorism more broadly to be armed thugs misbehaving and undermining legitimate society and governing institutions, then it goes hand in hand in all kinds of societies.
Mark Kleiman, would you like to add to that?
The paradox here is that when we say drugs are linked with terrorism, which certainly true at some level, then the obvious inference from that is that when we fight drugs by putting drug users in prison, we're fighting terrorism. And the only problem with that proposition is it's the opposite of the truth. Fighting the drug war, as we are in Afghanistan, for example, has the natural consequence of enriching people in the drug business. For every drug dealer you've arrested, you've just taken away a competitor from all the other drug dealers. More than that, drug enforcement gives an advantage to those drug dealers with the best access to either violence or corruption to be able to resist enforcement. And so not only are you increasing the amount of money in the drug trade by pushing up the prices, you're also increasing the nastiness of the drug trade by giving an advantage to the most unpleasant organizations.
So in Afghanistan, the result of heavy drug pressure on poppy growing in government-held provinces is poppy growing in Taliban-held provinces. We basically made the Taliban a monopolist for the entire Asian heroin trade. So the connection between drugs and terror, which is absolutely real, does not mean that everything we do that's, quote, against drugs is somehow helpful in fighting terrorism. That's not the case. And one of the hardest lessons to learn about drug policy is when less is more, when what the problem really needs is a good leaving alone.
One of the questions you raised in the book with regards to this particular connection was whether or not it would make sense then to legalize and regulate drugs rather than to continue down the path that we're going. But it sounds like you think that there are consequences to that as well. What might those consequences be? What are the arguments against doing this in an entirely different way, legalizing, regulating, and so to diminish the violence, diminish this underground drug trade that is highly lethal?
I guess the short version of that is legalizing is a lot easier than regulating. You can repeal the criminal laws, and then you're going to have an upsurge in, right? So you've now just made the drugs cheaper and more available, and so you'd expect a lot more drug use. And the answer is, well, we need to tax and regulate the industry. Every one of those taxes and every one of those regulations is worth evading if it's effective enough to actually get in the way of somebody's drug use. It's not as if we could replace prohibition with taxes and regulations unless we made it wanted to make the taxes and regulations so weak as to not be worth defying, which is essentially our picture with alcohol. Alcohol is the one addictive intoxicant we decided to legalize. It causes more drug abuse, more violence, more crime, more domestic violence, and more incarceration than all the illegal drugs combined. So as soon as somebody shows me an alcohol policy that actually gets the alcohol problem down to the level of the cocaine problem, I'm not going to be very convinced by people who say, oh, let's treat our cocaine problem the way we now treat alcohol.
What is your response to that? How do we approach this if, in fact, here we have this highly addictive and destructive drug, which is alcohol, and it's the one that's legal? Well, cigarettes are legal, too. They're pretty addictive, and while they're not connected to crime in the same way.
In places that have done something I mostly support, which is greatly increasing tobacco taxes in order to reduce nicotine abuse, you get crime. You get illegal tobacco dealing, some of which actually is operated by and supports terrorist groups in Europe. So I think our basic answer is grow up. This is part of the human situation. It's not going to go away. And our policies can influence what sort of problem they have. But not having a drug problem is not on the menu of available options. And that means both the people who think we cannot have a drug problem by winning the war on drugs and people who think we cannot have a drug problem by legalizing everything. We're going to have drug abuse, and if we have any rules at all, we're going to have some violations of those rules and the need to enforce them and possibly even violence and disorder around evading them. We could do a lot better than we're doing now. If we stopped pursuing fantasy goals, there are actually a number of real goals that are within reach, as Angela said. We're getting a lot smarter about controlling the drug abuse of drug-involved offenders, who are a huge part of the total problem.
It seems like the states are trying different approaches now. I think Arizona passed some treatment laws. California passed some treatment laws. I don't know how close they are to hope. Perhaps we can examine if they are having an impact that is as good as the one in Hawaii, the HOPE Project. Angela, it sounds like this is in your field.
Right. Well, what Arizona did in California, what they had implemented were what are called treatment diversion programs. That's something very different from what Hawaii experimented with their HOPE model. Arizona was the first state to pass treatment diversion laws, and essentially what that means is if someone's arrested on a drug charge, a nonviolent drug charge, they have the opportunity of being treated at a community-based provider rather than going to jail or prison or just staying on probation without otherwise being treated. California's was the largest experiment. We implemented ours in 2001. And I was originally very enthusiastic about what that would mean. I thought that was a smart move in the right direction. Unfortunately, the data hasn't supported the effort. What we've seen has been an increase in criminality among those who've been referred to treatment, and largely because large numbers don't go, and even if they do go, they don't finish the treatment to which they are mandated. There's very little opportunity for law enforcement in these states with treatment diversion laws to hold people accountable, to make sure that they actually go to the treatment providers and receive their treatment. And if they're rearrested on a drug charge, all that the judges can do is sentence them again to the treatment that they refused to go to in the first place. What we're much more enthusiastic about is the more strategic approach that Hawaii has taken, and that is put people on probation, monitor them closely, regular random drug testing, and every time they test positive, give them a small dose of punishment. And the key there really is small. It's a good parenting model. If your child is young and does something that they shouldn't do, you don't kick them out of the house. You basically explain to them that this is something that's incorrect. You make sure you dole out a small dose of punishment and allow them to learn from their bad behavior. And this is exactly what's happening in Hawaii. There's now credibility for the first time in the criminal justice system. A list of rules are given to the offenders and they're told they need to comply. And if they don't, there's an immediate consequence. In most jurisdictions, the dose of punishment is long, which is unnecessary, it's expensive, and it doesn't help reform behavior. And it also takes a long time for that punishment to kick in. Often people have to have 16 violations before any action is taken. And if action is taken, it might happen 6 weeks or 2 months from now. And by the time the person is sanctioned, they don't even know why they're in trouble anymore, because they've cleaned up since then and life is back to normal. To reducing the time between consequence and action is extremely important for bringing about behavior change, and that's what they're doing in Hawaii. Other states are copying the model with very good success.
Which states are copying it?
Well, there's a number of them now. Arizona had a similar experience with their drug treatment diversion program not working very well, and their version of HOPE is called SAFE in Arizona. There's now a number of jurisdictions in Arizona. They're also starting up juvenile versions of the model, which we're very enthusiastic about. Because if you think of this as good parenting, well, a population that should respond very well to this kind of modeling is the juveniles. And their brains are still shaping. Learning to follow rules at a young age is certainly very helpful in terms of an entire criminal career trajectory. So we have Arizona, California, Alaska was the first state after Hawaii to implement theirs. Washington State has a beautiful version of this model operating in parole. California's model that they started out with was with a parolee population, and the early data from that shows that they've really managed to control drug use in a way that I was stunned at just how much they managed to break the back of the drug problem among that parolee population. So California's looking to expand the model now. Arizona's expanding, and we'll see similar expansions in other states.
What about on the federal level or on the international level? Has the approach to addressing the drug issue changed at all?
More in rhetoric than in reality so far. There's a little bit more willingness to discuss the problem realistically than there was 20 years ago. And certainly in some places, and Mexico is one of them, the drug effort has become controversial because of the huge level of violence. But the slogans are still pretty much the same. The international organizations are still pretty much the same. The new head of the UN Office on Drugs and Crime was the head of the Russian anti-drug effort, a furious drug war hawk. So I think it's reasonable to predict that there will be more change in the near future than there's been in the recent past. But it's certainly not moving fast.
Jonathan Calkins, I hear you coming in.
The world's a big place. There are many countries, and some have done interesting and important changes. France did not have a large methadone maintenance program 20 years ago. They have since expanded it dramatically. So they provide much more treatment to their heroin users than they did in the past. Iran also has made a very dramatic shift from a purely punitive approach to its heroin and morphine dependent users to a great expansion in treatment. Iran, although maybe not everybody realizes, has perhaps the world's highest rate of opiate addiction. So that was an important change.
And what about the politicization of both the science about drugs and the policies that work or don't work? Do you find that that is changing, or is it still very politicized?
The optimistic side of me says that people have calmed down an awful lot since the late 1980s, when we were, frankly, really scared by crack and violent street markets that were really making some major American cities all but uninhabitable in some parts for normal commerce and daily activities. I think it's a lot easier to have a conversation now that gets away from panicked reflexive actions in and as reflective and thoughtful. It's not easy because we have decades of myths and decades of emotional reactions that we have to work through to get to compromise and progress. But I think it's easier now than it was in the past.
And so where do you think we should go from here?
One of the things that I encourage is the use of incarceration more selectively against suppliers who create unusually severe problems for the communities around them. Currently, the long sentences are primarily driven by the quantity possessed, but quantity possessed is a poor indicator of how destructive somebody is to society. If we can focus the longer sentences on the subset of dealers who are truly violent, on the subset of dealers who employ children, who sell outside treatment clinics, we can use the enforcement much more selectively, reduce the number of people in prison, and in some sense, put the nastiest dealers at competitive disadvantage relative to the ones who are selling through social networks and selling in ways that are less destructive.
I support what John said there. We should really be using our prison cells for people who won't stop stealing and those who continue to hurt others. I think we've now figured out approaches to managing the drug users in the community, and saving those cells for people who harm others seems to be an advantage from the perspective of public safety for sure.
Well, again, the book is called Drugs and Drug Policy, What Everyone Needs to Know. We've been speaking with the co-authors. There's three of them, Mark Kleiman, Jonathan Calkins, Angela Hawken. They are all professors at universities. Mark Kleiman is a professor of public policy at UCLA Luskin School of Public Affairs, and he's written numerous books, including When Brute Force Fails, How to Have Less Crime and Less Punishment. Jonathan Calkins is professor of operations research and public policy at Carnegie Mellon University's Qatar campus, and at the Hines School of Public Policy. And Angela Hawken is professor of economics and policy analysis at the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. Thank you all so very much.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests, and special thanks to Ankina Aghasian, Melissa Ciprin, Ishmael Karim, and Amanda Vigil, who helped produce today's show. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org and click on the audio archives. You can also keep up with us at scholarcircle.org or armudian.com, or follow me on Twitter at armudian.